Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Barbara Bockwith, a University of West Florida college student, arrives early for her final exam. The accounting major had been up all night studying and it was exhausted, but when she arrived, she realized that she had forgotten her notes in her car. With just 10 minutes to spare before she needed to be back, she rushed off to her car to get them. She never made it back. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Julia Riley.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, today we're talking about Barbara Bockwith, who I mentioned before, if you remember. Do you remember?
I think so, but we've talked about a few Barbaras.
There are a few Barbaras. So Barbara, I mentioned in our episode on Joanna Otto, and I highly recommend everyone go and check that episode out, Joanna's episode, though you don't need to watch it to understand Barbara's story. And the reason that they're connected for me personally is that I learned about Joanna's story when researching Barbara's case. So Barbara came first. Then I learned about Joanna. And that's because in the 1990s, a skeleton was found on the University of West Florida campus. And because both Barbara and Joanna were missing from Pensacola, there was a real hope that this discovery might finally bring closure to at least one of their families. It turned out to be a fake lab skeleton, though.
So it wasn't even real bone either?
No.
Okay. Imagine that, just pulling something up and being like,
We found it!
And it's plastic. Somebody.
Yeah, no. Yeah, so there was all these, like, immediate articles about maybe it's Barbara, maybe it's Joanna, because Barbara actually went missing from the campus. Joanna went missing from the town, you know, so everyone was hopeful it was one of them, but it wasn't. But share Joanna's story first, and about, like, her mom's memorial to her and to other missing children, and we're going to swing back. We're going to cover Barbara today. Okay, so we're just going to dive in to Barbara's story.
Okay.
On the morning of December 5th, 1979, 20-year-old Barbara Bockwith parked her bright red Toyota Celica in one of the lots at the University of West Florida. Likely, Barbara was at this point exhausted. It was final exams week on campus, and she'd spent all night studying at her parents' house where she lived. Her dad had peeked in on her early that morning, and she was still up reviewing her notes over and over. But now it was time for the test. And after walking through the brisk early afternoon air and heading towards Building 58, she talked to some friends outside. Everyone had to have been nervous for this exam. Like, this, there's this, like, high-key energy that I've always, like, witnessed when college students have, like, exam time, right? Like,
and you have experience with that.
Yeah.
You are the one stressing them out in these cases.
Yeah, so I always bent the rules. Like, even, like, when it was, like, required exams, like, I mean, there'd always be some sort of end paper. But, like, I remember, like, before taking a test, like, that, like, anxiety, like, you've studied and studied and studied and, like, you're not quite confident about what's going to be on the test.
Right? Yeah.
And Barbara Bockwith herself, like, she has that, like, unmistakable type A energy to me. She's organized. She's efficient. She's, like, laser focused. Right. And then Barbara notices something. Her friends all have their notes with them.
Oh.
And of course, she knows that this is an open note test, but she'd forgotten hers back in her car. Okay. So she said goodbye to her friends and hustled back to the parking lot. She's likely eager to grab her notes and get back in time to settle in for the test. But Barbara Bockwith never makes it to the exam.
That's it? She went missing in just the time she went to get her notes?
Yes. So somewhere along the way, she disappears. And now, almost 46 years later, she is one of Pensacola, Florida's missing women. But to tell Barbara's story, we can't lose sight of who she was. And she's not like just a campus ghost story or a name on a plaque somewhere. Like, she was someone who had like dreams and goals and deserves to be remembered. So she's someone whose family is still today hoping for answers.
Are they saying that she's haunting the campus?
I don't know. But when people go missing from a campus, they're often turned into a ghost story. So if there is a University of West Florida ghost story about Barbara, like, please let us know.
Yes.
Because very often they are transformed into some sort of...
Well, I've been kind of interested in that lately because quite a few of the cases we've talked about do kind of have like a ghost story attached.
Yes.
And I think it would be really cool one day to just like go over some of those a little
bit
in
an episode.
Yeah.
But that would be a great idea.
I think it would be, it would be a... like a fun way to bring these names back to everybody, too.
Yeah, I'll work on one then.
Okay.
Okay. Now, before we go on, this episode does include conversation about a death by suicide, and it does contain some detail about that, though it's not graphic.
Mm-hmm.
We'll also be talking about intimate partner violence and stalking, so if that's not for you, you may want to sit this one out. Now, Barbara was born in 1958 and was a force her entire life. She graduated from Escambia High School at just 17 and then quickly went on to study at Pensacola Junior College. In a 2024 interview, her brother Charlie said she was on a great track. She was an accounting student. She had good grades. She was one of the youngest people to have a real estate license at the time, which is true. Her parents, John and Neva, had quit their own promising jobs at other companies to form their own real estate business when Barbara was about 16 years old. By the time Barbara was 18, she also got her real estate license, making her one of the youngest, if not the youngest, in the state to do so. And by the time she was finishing up junior college, many of her friends were getting married, but Barbara had different plans. She was on her way to University of West Florida to study accounting. It's not that Barbara wasn't interested in romantic relationships, though, to be clear, like she was. But things have always been kind of complicated and difficult when it came to that for her. When she was 16, she started dating this guy named R, who was about 5 years older than her. So he was about 21 when they started seeing one another. The two dated until around the time she was 18, and then they broke up. But they continued to be friends, but... some describe their relationship as more of an on-again, off-again kind of thing.
Okay. We're going with an initial here.
We are, yes.
Okay.
Now, so Barbara really, she seems to just dig into her studies. She's focusing on taking her exams and getting her degree, which is why in the early morning hours of December 5th, 1979, Barbara was frantically studying. At their Navy Point home, her father actually checked in on her at 4 a.m., likely wondering why she was still awake, but he found her still studying, so he went back to bed. When Barbara's parents woke up around 2 hours later, which was around 6 a.m., they found a note from her saying she was going to a friend's house to study. If anyone has been up all night studying, you know how like ravenous you are in those early morning hours. So it's no wonder that Barbara and her close friend Betty headed to McDonald's around 7:20 a.m. Barbara ordered hotcakes. I'm guessing she realized how exhausted she must have been, certainly not at the peak of your like test-taking mode after being up all night. So she drove back to her family home and took a nap before heading to campus to take her test. That's when she made her way to Building 58 and realized she left some things in her car. Later, her friends would say that she headed to her car around 11:10 a.m., and she should have been back in time for her 11:20 a.m. exam to start, but Barbara never arrived. But these friends were actually not the last ones to see Barbara that day. While her classmates were on campus making their way through their test, Barbara was spotted 4 miles away driving her car through the intersection of Creighton Road and 9th Avenue. That's about a good 10-ish minute drive from campus. A lifelong friend of hers, someone who knew Barbara well and also her bright red Toyota Celica, saw her driving south through this intersection. Barbara looked to be alone, and when the friend waved, Barbara waved back. And this is just like a really haunting image to me, like Barbara in her car going through this intersection. It's like proof that she was alive after leaving campus, right? Like, and yet so close to just being missing.
But also it's so bizarre that she's just going to get her notes and then all of a sudden she's driving somewhere.
Yeah. Like what happened?
Like what happened in the meantime to make that happen?
Yeah. And so she's seen around noon. Right. But the test started at 11:20.
Yeah. It just doesn't add up.
So, like, what is happening in those, like, you know, 40 to 50 minutes?
Right. Because when you said that, I was assuming, like, oh, you know, somebody was waiting at the vehicle or.
Yeah.
But she's alone.
Right. So, like, this one sighting.
Or appears to be alone anyways.
Mm-hmm. Of her off campus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, at their own home, her parents, though, like, to them, nothing is amiss. Like, to their knowledge, their daughter went to campus that day, was taking the test that she had studied so hard for. And though they're initially concerned when she didn't come home that evening, they were trying not to worry. After all, like, though she lived at home with them, they were trying hard to treat her as an adult. Now, the next morning, they expected to get a phone call from Barbara. She was what they called their 60-minute child, which was a phrase I'd never heard of. But basically, okay, to them, it meant that if her plans ever changed, she would call them within an hour to update them on those plans, right? Because in the pre-cell phone days, like,
right,
just like calling home being like, this is what's going on.
I right? like that about her.
Yeah.
That so seems responsible.
Completely responsible. That's the Barbara they know.
Like, and right? and just like conscientious of like what her parents need.
Yeah. So like, you know, she did this even when she went on a trip to Germany, like when they wouldn't know that her plans had changed, you know?
Right. Like they would, it would not affect them in the least. Yeah. And she's still letting them know.
Right, updating. So like, there's this balance that they're trying to walk here between like, she's 20 years old, she's trying to be an adult, we have to treat her like an adult, like mm-hmm. maybe she doesn't need to update us every hour about whether or not her plans change. On the other hand, this is out of character for her.
Right. On the other hand, I mean, for her, I think that's, it's kind of like a sign of maturity to be like, oh, this is what I'm doing at this time. Like, I'm making my own plan still, but I'm just letting you know where I am.
Right. Because like, it's responsible to update people, so they're not left wondering.
Right.
Now, so they're trying to give her space, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were worried the night before because her absence really like had built into something completely out of the ordinary for her mm-hmm. by this point, right? It's now been a good amount of time since they heard from her. So by 1 in the afternoon, their worry just bubbles over and they call the Escambia County Sheriff's Department. And with 15 minutes, some sheriff's officers arrived at the Bockwith home to fill out preliminary forms. This was the first step in acknowledging that Barbara might be missing.
Okay, so she's been missing for how long now?
So it's been about, since the person saw her in the vehicle, we're at like 25 hours of okay. her last being seen.
So they're, like, it took a little time to respond, but they're doing it quickly because they were leaving space for her.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Now, by the next day, though, the 7th, it's clear that something is very wrong.
Mm-hmm.
At 4 p.m. that afternoon, her parents went to the sheriff's department themselves and spoke to Chief Investigator Floyd Rose about Barbara's disappearance. No one had seen her since noon on the 5th, so now that we're about 52 hours out.
Okay.
So, like, things are just
yeah.
building, right? Now, that evening, several of Barbara's friends gathered at the Bockwith house, and they decided to call the sheriff's department again. This time, the investigators arrived to find a gathering of about 10 people. All of them were eager to find Barbara, and they were all actually willing to share what they thought was wrong. And what they kept on coming back to that evening was all the problems that she'd been having with her ex-boyfriend, R, since the two of them had broken up.
So was the friends and family talking together about the boyfriend?
Yes.
Okay. Are we going to talk about some of those problems?
We are. We do have to dive in to kind of what the situation
right. was. Right. I know we don't like talking about them.
Yeah, but it's impossible not to because so much of her last few years of her life right. was really marked by this experience. Now,
okay.
R was an oil rigman who was working out of Louisiana at this point, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he actually lived not far from Barbara's childhood home, like his home base. So just two blocks away, actually. And despite Barbara and R breaking up 2 years before, she hadn't been able to fully break away from him. I'm like sure the close proximity is part of this, but they also shared mutual friends and connections. And so despite their breakup, he was incredibly possessive of Barbara.
So neither of them ever moved on to other relationships?
Well, yeah. Oh, Barbara was trying, right? Because
okay.
this possessiveness really began to escalate in the year and a half before she disappeared. And part of that was because as of April 1978, Barbara was trying to date again.
Okay.
And this is like not long after the two had broken up, right? Barbara was at this point in April of 1978, hanging out with a potential new boyfriend at her friend Anne's house. Now, for clarity, Anne is the sister of Betty, and Betty is the friend that Barbara went to breakfast with the day she disappeared.
McDonald's. Okay.
Yeah. Now, it would be an understatement to say that R wasn't happy about the potential of Barbara moving on.
Mm-hmm.
And upon learning that Barbara was at Anne's with a new guy, he drove to Anne's place and burst into her home, heading straight for Barbara's date. R actually hit this guy in the face several times.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. On April 11th, R was arrested on Pensacola Beach for this attack and was charged with trespassing and battery. And R really didn't have any defense. Like, there were plenty of witnesses, and it was clear he'd committed a crime. That's likely why he pleaded guilty to battery on June 31st, 1978. Now, despite this, things only continued to escalate. At the end of July, Barbara reported another crime. She said that he had kicked her car in the rear, so I'm guessing the back bumper, and caused damage. And it wasn't cheap either. It was about $80 worth of damage that he did to her car. So she actually went to go collect money for him for these damages. And that's when he slammed his car into hers.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah. Now, once out of the vehicle, he actually grabbed at her and hit her arm. And then he grabbed the necklace she was wearing around her neck and yanked it off from her. And then he walked away with it. And this had to be completely terrifying. And for some clarity here, this guy is like 6'3", and Barbara was 5'4", and all of like 115 pounds.
So he seems really violent right now. Back when they were dating, from the time like she was 16 to 18, you said, was he ever violent with her at that point?
That's actually an interesting question. I didn't see any...
Like, were there red flags, I guess, like, is before, what I'm getting to. Because, you know, like, as a parent, you're watching your kid date and, like, see, like, and friends are watching and everything. And, like, were there these red flags?
So most of the people in interviews that I read, they really focused on what happened after.
Only after. Okay.
And there wasn't much conversation about what her relationship with him was like before. So I don't think these things came out of nowhere. I'm guessing that they probably were part of her life.
Well, it was probably the reason for the big breakup in the first place.
Yeah. So this is pretty intense.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of extreme, like hitting her car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, ripping the necklace off of her. Yeah.
Hitting the new boyfriend. It's pretty violent.
Yeah. So on July 22nd, he's booked on charges of battery, criminal mischief, and petty larceny. I'm assuming for the theft of the necklace, right?
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after, on August 11th, he pleaded guilty to the trespassing charge from the incident at Anne's house. So this is just kind of like all falling into pieces. Now, despite what was a clear pattern of behavior, the state attorney at the time, Denver Fellers, decided to essentially drop the case for the charges stemming from the time she confronted him about paying for the damages in the car. So all of that, like the petty larceny, the battery, all that off the table.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
He drops the charges.
He drops the charges because she asked for money?
Well, I don't know why he dropped the charges.
Is that why? Because he's like... Was he like, she made him angry by doing that? That's what I got from what you said. Like, is it not? Like
that's the assumption.
That's I'm jumping to conclusions.
You might be, but it's clear that like this whole incident to him, like all those things that stemmed from this incident, like he just drops the charges. I'm not sure the rationale.
I don't know why you would though.
Yeah.
There's obviously like.
There's a clear pattern
damage you can see. There are other witnesses. There are other people he's abused.
Yeah. Now.
Okay.
Like, she had to feel so alone in this after he decides not to do that. And both her friend Betty and Barbara's older brother, Charlie, attested to knowing that there were other acts of vandalism and harassment that just didn't end up in court. Betty said, after their breakup, things were done to her. Things that happened again. Recently, there were chemicals poured on her car and he was following her around. So there was, like, a definite pattern of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the week before her disappearance, Barbara confided in Betty that R would slap her down, that's in her words, if he caught her out with another man, particularly if Barbara went with someone else to a Pensacola lounge specifically, because that spot was their spot and it would enrage him if she went there.
How's this guy just like everywhere all the time?
Well, because he's like stalking her.
He's right? full out stalking her yeah. at this point.
Now, there is a gap of time in which things seem to have calmed down after the breakup. And that's because he actually went to Louisiana to do work.
Oh.
Right. But now he's back.
Okay.
Right. Now, Barbara went missing on a Wednesday, but on the Friday before she disappeared, she did go on a date with a new guy. Despite her misgivings about what she told Betty, that the two, you know, shouldn't go to this lounge, they did.
Okay.
It's not clear if R knew that the two went there or that she had gone on the date, but we do know that Barbara and R talked on Saturday, the day after this date. So, they Friday talked on date.
Saturday.
Saturday is the conversation with R. Wednesday, she disappears. Now, this history of violence and intimidation of Barbara is the history that her friends and family related to investigators as everyone gathered at the family's home on the night of December 7th. They all thought it was imperative that the officers be informed about the couple's history now that Barbara was missing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the time the officers left at 1:34 that morning, everyone probably felt confident that Barbara's case would be investigated and that their concerns about the ex-boyfriend would be looked into, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as we often learn in these cases, that wasn't exactly what happened. By 9 a.m., it was her family and friends who began printing out and distributing a missing persons flyer for Barbara and placing them around campus. And by midnight, after they hadn't heard anything new, her family actually called the Florida Highway Patrol in Tallahassee and the Pensacola Police Department to see if they had heard anything about Barbara's case. Now, remember, it was Escambia County sheriffs who were handling it, and what should have been routine, which was contacting the local police and also the highway department about the disappearance of a 20-year-old college student, both agencies said that they hadn't received any information about it.
Hmm. Really?
Yeah. So it's like, oh, you feel like they're responding right away. They came out and took a report.
Yeah.
Right? And they just didn't really do anything with it after that.
Jeez.
Now, thinking that this wasn't possible, that they must be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They had a relative call the Pensacola Police Department again the next day, and they were told the same answer. There was no report of Barbara being missing. Now, it's clear at this point to her family that new measures would have to be taken to find Barbara.
I mean, it's kind of what happened with Joanna's case, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was just sort of like, eh.
Hey. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll be back in a moment.
Now, by 9 a.m. on Sunday, Barbara's father, John, contacted Robert Waldrop. We're going to hear quite a bit about him.
Okay.
Robert Waldrop. He's a private detective. Now, by 6 p.m., the two had met, and Robert began interviewing 15 people, which included actually Tom Jones from the Escambia Sheriff's Office, likely to get an understanding of where the investigation was. He also spoke to R, Barbara's ex-boyfriend. Now,
is he the first person to speak to R?
I'm unclear.
We're not sure.
Presumably, everyone thought that the police had left her parents' house to go question R that night after that meeting,
mm-hmm.
but it's not clear from the reporting whether or not that happened.
Okay.
Now, Waldrop, he's officially on the case. He's working to figure out where Barbara might be. Now, there are a lot of theories circulating already about Barbara's disappearance, and of course, some suspected the ex-boyfriend, right?
Mm-hmm.
But some thought maybe she just left on her own. To check all of his boxes, Waldrop went to the local municipal airport to look around. And by 9 a.m., he was placing a call to the sheriff's department. They needed to come down. He thought he had found her car. Barbara's red Celica was indeed at the airport in the long-term parking lot. An attendant said it had been parked there sometime before midnight on the day that she disappeared. This led some to speculate that she had parked it there and then, for some reason, flown out. But a check of outgoing flights revealed that Barbara hadn't been on any of them. But a look at her car did reveal a few things that were out of the ordinary. For one, Barbara always placed her books, bags, and really like whatever else she had with her for the day on the front passenger seat. That's where all of my stuff goes.
Me too. Yeah.
And then I always hate when someone's sitting in the passenger seat because I'm like, yeah. Where's all my stuff going to go right now? Instead, these items have been moved to the back seat. Almost as though someone had been sitting in that front passenger seat.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, her purse was missing from her car. and her driver's seat was moved all the way back. Now, at 5'4", this would have been too far back for Barbara to drive. Now, when people go missing, their cars are not always found, so this had to have felt like a major development in the case, but the sheriff's office largely pushed aside what were glaring clues to anyone who knew Barbara. When her father and Waldrop pointed out how far back the seat was, the sheriffs just said that maybe it was left in that position by Barbara herself. Maybe she was stretching and had moved it back.
Really?
Yeah.
So when I get in my car and my seat's not where I want it, I get really annoyed. Mm-hmm. So there's no way I would move it out and then like just leave it.
No.
Because when I get in, I want it to be in the right spot. In the
perfect spot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. It's like Betty, who had at this point in her life driven in the car with Barbara hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. Right. She said that Barbara had never done that mm-hmm. in all of their times of being together in the car. Like, this was not something
Barbara right. did. And it's also awkward. Like, it's easier to just get out
and stretch
and like, go into the doing? Back.
Yeah. Now, all of this was not enough to convince the officers that something was up. Later, when the officers were supposed to have processed the car for evidence, they only did a cursory examination of the car. They don't even dust it for fingerprints. The excuse they give later is that this oversight seems to have been because of the texture of her car's interior, like that it was a like nubby texture.
Oh my gosh.
It would have rendered this pointless, that they wouldn't have found clear prints in the first place. And they didn't do an exterior dusting either. And they said that was pointless because the car had been sitting outside for 5 days.
Maybe we just try anyway.
Yeah. So, you know, since investigators have said like, okay, well, maybe you might not have found something, but like you just.
But just in case.
Do it as a matter of course.
Right. Right.
But probably more to the point is that the sheriff's office wasn't even certain that they were dealing with a crime. Investigator Jones said it's a 50-50 situation. She could have just left or there could have been foul play. But there's no evidence to support either. We've got a hell of a lot of suspicions, but suspicions don't work. We're following them all up, but we don't know anything yet. And this was echoed by Sergeant Dick Barlow, who would say there's no evidence that a crime was committed. There's nothing to indicate that she is either alive or dead, so we're going on the assumption that she is still alive. And Barlow also said, from a legal standpoint, the sheriff's department still has to face the fact that this is a missing adult and she has a legal right to go anywhere she pleases.
But people don't just go like that.
Yeah. Like,
I'm on my way to get my notes and now I'm going to the airport and there's no record of me flying out and
yeah,
there's weird things with my car. Like, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. I literally stayed up all night studying.
Right.
And I just disappear.
Right. And I usually tell my parents where I am and I do all of these things, but I also have a stalker.
Right. What could that have to do with anything?
Right.
Now, Waldrop, though, he's, again, the private detective. He's considering other possibilities and angles. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the people who arrived at the airport parking lot after Barbara's car was discovered was actually R. He apparently had heard her car was found. So seizing the moment, Waldrop scheduled an appointment with R, asking him to come in the next morning to take a lie detector test. R readily agreed, and the two planned to meet at 9 a.m. the next day in Waldrop's office. But the next day, 9 a.m. came and went without sight of R at the office.
Surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, at some point in the day, it seems that Waldrop and Barbara's brother Charlie spoke about the fact that R hadn't come in for his polygraph. That combined with like a rumor that was circulating that R could have one of those hide keys, which is like one of those key hiding devices.
Hmm?
Yeah.
Like,
I feel like I need more information here, but I get the impression that like there's some sort of suspicion that R might have a key access to like Barbara's spaces or maybe even Barbara's house. Now,
okay.
Charlie went out looking for him. Charlie drove by R's house 3 times looking to see if he was home, but he didn't see anyone there. On the 4th visit, though, Charlie returned for another drive past R's house. Now, remember, this is just a few blocks away mm-hmm. from the Bockwith home. But this time, Charlie brought Betty with him and 2 other women. This time, instead of just driving past, they stopped. They thought they'd seen a light come on inside, and they wanted to see if R was actually there. The 4 entered through the garage.
They went in?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Was R home?
Well, It's inside the garage that they find R dead.
Really?
From a single gunshot wound to the chest.
Self-inflicted?
Yeah.
Huh.
And beside him was the gun. Now, Charlie, Betty, and the other friends, they ran back to the Bockwith house. And there they found the private investigator, Waldrop, who was touching base with Barbara's parents. And they relayed to all of them what they had seen. So the sheriff's department was called. Later, inside the house, on a table, they found a suicide note addressed to R's mother. It made no mention of Barbara. It did contain a mention of a pressure he was feeling prior to his death.
Imagine going in there and if those other four would have been suspects now. That never happened, right?
No.
They knew. It was like very, very clear.
It was very clear.
Good. Because when you said that, I'm like, oh no, they're going to get pinned for something they didn't do.
Well, I shouldn't say very clear. There has been suspicions and like chatter out in the world sense that like
Charlie did it or
not to the Charlie, no, but like okay. That someone else was involved. Although like this is just like part of the rumor mill.
Yeah. So,
like, I don't know, but like there's like lots of questions about how he could have done this self-inflicted gunshot wound. I don't know all the details, okay. But I just know that.
Just it's like the wrong time to turn up at somebody's house unannounced and like break in, essentially.
Yeah. And particularly when there's like already built in tension. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, despite the fact that someone who might have been a suspect died from suicide not long after his ex disappeared, the sheriff's office seemed reluctant to pursue that angle. Hmm. Investigator Tom Jones said that when they spoke to his friends, they all said that their sense of R was that he would have, in their words, cut off his right arm before harming her.
But he's already harmed her.
Exactly. Like, honestly, this just baffles me. Like, he has a clear history of harassing Barbara, even grabbing her and physically assaulting men who might have been interested in her.
Uh-huh.
So, like, but this sentiment is even echoed by Betty's sister, Anne.
Really?
Yeah. So, remember, Anne is the one whose house he literally burst into to punch another man in the face.
Right. Didn't he get the... What was it? It was like the...
Yeah, he had like a trespassing charge
because of going into her house. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, Anne said that he was hard-headed and had a mean temper at times. Other times he could be gentle as a lamb.
Like every abusive person.
Exactly. Now, she said she spoke with him that night before his death and he seemed despondent to her and he emphasized that he couldn't hurt Barbara. So this was like enough for her.
But he did, Anne.
Like, he assaulted her.
He ripped a necklace off of her.
Mm-hmm. Damaged her car, stalked her.
Hit her car with his car.
Yeah. Now, Charlie said that he even got a call from an old friend of R's who said that R had promised to kill himself if any harm had ever come to Barbara. So there's like really this push to downplay what had been consistent and disturbing behavior prior to Barbara's disappearance.
But also, he promised to kill himself if any harm ever came to Barbara. Barbara is now missing. Obviously, he harmed her.
Yeah.
And then went into one of his lamb phases and killed himself.
Like, I have a million things to say here.
Like, come on. Like,
what is clear that is happening here, though, among all of this, is this ingrained belief that, like, love is somehow entangled with possessiveness.
Right.
Like, that he must really love her because he was super possessive of her, right? And that's, like, this somehow, like, a hallmark of true love. And honestly, like, I see that belief and it's rampant now, but, like, that is particularly apparent in this case.
Right. And when you're talking possessiveness, we're not talking, like, that's my girl.
Yay.
That's cute. We're talking about, I own that girl.
Exactly.
Not cute.
Yeah. Now, I also want to add at this point that R should, and this is what you were saying a little bit ago, he should, in theory, only know that the woman he supposedly loves is missing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why would his desire not be to, like, tear the whole world apart looking for her?
Right.
Instead, as his friend relayed to Charlie, R said that he would kill himself if any harm came to her. So how would he know that if that's not what happened?
You're right. He should be out there searching. He should be trying to work with the police.
Yeah, something.
His girl is missing. Like, go find her.
Exactly.
Mm.
Now, Barbara's dad was suspicious of this, too. He said that on the night they learned Barbara was missing, R came over to the Bockwith house and he was sobbing. Her dad said he was crying as hard as I was. Why was he crying so hard if he didn't know something? Anyway, I don't usually talk extensively about my suspicions, but this case. Now, it's clear, though, that the sheriffs did not share my same thoughts on this at the time. They even brought a copy of R's suicide note to a handwriting specialist at the college who determined, based on his handwriting, that he could not have caused harm to Barbara.
What?
Yes.
So if we go through everybody in the world's handwriting, we can find out which people are capable of harming someone and which ones are not.
Yeah, there are like
based on handwriting.
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't we just pre-screen everyone? Why don't we just think on it? Like, why don't we do other kinds of crazy ways of coming up with whether or not someone's guilty?
Yeah. No. So I love that they invested that time.
Maybe a blood test will tell if someone's capable of murder.
Like, yeah. In our dystopian future.
Right.
Maybe.
Maybe we can just pluck a hair and see.
But like, yeah.
Yeah.
So like handwriting analysis.
No. No, no, no.
Now, with R's death and Barbara's disappearance, like few leads developed after her death. One thing that her family wrestled with is that they may not have been privy to everything in her life like they thought. They learned... You know,
maybe she's a young woman.
Yeah. So they learned, for instance, that it was possible that she could have had been a bit more on again than off again with R in the recent months. R had been, like I said, in Louisiana on the oil rigs, but he had returned recently. And he was definitely trying to reignite their relationship.
Okay.
Her father also learned that she owned a gun, which was purchased for her by R. Her father said he believed the gun was given to her because she was scared of being alone at night on campus, particularly because she frequented the university's computer lab at night. Her father was really surprised by this. Owning a gun was really out of the range of normal for Barbara, and Barbara was, in his words, light years away from knowing how to use one.
Yeah, it's kind of like a dangerous thing to give somebody who might not
know how to use
have experience. It doesn't sound like her father... I don't know, was he a gun owner?
Yeah, this doesn't really seem like the...
It doesn't seem like their family vibe.
No.
Especially if he's surprised by it. Yeah. So if she wasn't brought up around guns and isn't comfortable with guns, why would R think it's okay and safe to give her one?
Yeah, like that's the measure of safety,
right? Like you're actually, yeah.
Now, the rumors, though, they don't just end there. Like many families, the Bockwiths sought out information through every means possible, including through the use of psychics. One was a woman named Yolanda, who was actually quite well known at the time. She said that she had visions of Barbara that were largely blocked by some sort of unseen force. You're giving me a look as we're going through this.
You just let me yammer on about, like, why don't they just get a psychic?
Well, here we are.
Here we are.
Okay, now.
But this is her family this time, so they're probably just desperate, and this is probably, they don't know what else to do. So I will let this one go.
Okay, so Yolanda is kind of saying essentially that, like, she's only getting flashes of visions of maybe locations and maybe clothing flashes, right? Mm-hmm. And she said she could see maybe a gray barn or automotive company, and that there could be a sign on the building with a bird on it. She thought it had something to do with the military, but she couldn't tell if it meant that Barbara's remains were near a base or if the message just meant that there was a connected word that sounds like the military. We're like, Yolanda's covering a lot of bases.
Maybe it's about birds themselves.
Now, in any case, she believed, Yolanda did, that Barbara had met with a violent death and that the discovery of her body would trigger a large drug-related investigation that would, quote-unquote, blow the lid off Pensacola.
Okay. Was there any reason to believe that, just my curiosity, that R was involved with drugs?
Well, we're going to get on that.
Wait, okay.
Yeah, you're getting ahead per
usual. I'm getting ahead. Because, now, like, it doesn't, like, if he was involved with drugs, that's not a weird thing to say.
Well, yeah. So,
okay.
Now,
okay.
Two things, though, come out of Yolanda's visions, right? One is that John and Charlie end up spending a year searching the woods around Pensacola, trying to find evidence that lined up with Yolanda's visions and other psychics' visions, right? They said that they knew that they were clutching at straws, but they didn't know what else to do at this point. And they also felt that they had to search those locations because they couldn't not.
Well, I would.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I believe any of this, but I would definitely be searching.
Yeah, because, like, if you've got nothing.
This is at least better than nothing. At least it's something to do.
Exactly. So, like, because if they didn't, like, what if she was there and they didn't check?
Right. And what if.
What if the psychics. Well,
yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. What if? Mm-hmm. We don't know.
Yeah. So there's these, like, big what if questions.
Yeah. For them.
Now, the other thing that happens is that these psychic visions help kind of firm up a rumor that Barbara might have been involved in some sort of drug trade with R. Mm. Apparently, he'd been rumored to have sold drugs, and there may, at the very least, be a little bit of substance to that. Investigators today believe there's a possibility that either intentionally or unintentionally, Barbara could have gotten involved in this.
That makes the gun make sense.
A little bit more, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, last year when discussing the case, Colonel David Ingram said that it's possible that she could have planned to travel with R to Alabama on the day she went missing, which was not information that was circulated in 1979. But I think that it's impossible to think of Barbara's disappearance as separate from R.
Right. I mean, obviously, it's like, if anything like this happened, R is trying to bring her back into the relationship. R would probably be the one pushing this drug stuff and the gun on her. If she was having some back and forth with that, I could see where something could have gone really wrong. Like, where if she's like, no, I don't want to be part of this, or I don't want to be with you. And then, you know, when you get to like that part in like a relationship where you're not sure and you're second guessing yourself. And I'm wondering if she was just struggling with that, but also this guy's just not leaving. He's being so persistent.
Exactly. And like, I don't want to... What I want to emphasize, I'm going to step back for a second, mm-hmm. is that there has been no information released publicly that there has anything to do with drugs on Barbara's side.
Okay. Right?
That this has not been substantiated by other claims. But this is part of the rumors about, like, her disappearance. And some of that comes from, like, this Yolanda
right.
kind of moment.
Do we ever find evidence of R doing it?
So the police have, from my knowledge, not released any information about that, right? I just know that, like, recently they said that this was something that they were pursuing, that maybe this is a possibility.
Okay.
That unintentionally, so it's all just or not, right?
Maybe, maybe, maybe.
Maybe, maybe, maybe.
Okay.
Right? But what we do know is that there was a young, very driven and focused college student who was studying for her test, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way she was going to miss that test. She stayed up all night
mm-hmm.
studying for that test.
And regardless of any of these rumors, she was really responsible.
Exactly.
Right. With her schoolwork and with her parents and with
her. She wouldn't have just taken off. She had a focused plan for her life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's who Barbara is.
Right.
So whatever the case might be, the fact is she is still missing.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one-year anniversary of her disappearance, her father said, "It's been a year-long funeral." On the second anniversary, he said, "For the past 2 years, it's as if we've been living in a time warp. Time stopped for us on December 5th, 1979. We believe that Barbara is dead. We have no hope that she is alive, but we cannot rest until we know for sure." And in 1984, despite not being able to bury her, her family had Barbara declared legally dead, and Barbara's father died in 1989. He'd spent his last years waking up in the middle of the night wondering where his daughter was, and her mother slept every night in Barbara's bedroom. In 1989, Neva Bakwa said, "I don't think I'll see Barbara return in my lifetime." And Neva was right. In 2006, she passed away, not any closer to learning what happened to her daughter.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Witness, read by Julia Riley. Julia is an actress born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. She plays Danny Miller on Great American Family's original series, County Rescue, and recently played Amy March in the GFA film, A Little Woman's Christmas. Another notable credit is playing the role of Tammy Thompson in season 4 of Netflix's Stranger Things.
Julia was nominated for the Grace Prize for TV Performance at the 2025 Movie Guide Awards, as well as sharing other nominations and wins for County Rescue and A Little Woman's Christmas. Other credits include lead and supporting roles in films featured on Lifetime, Amazon Prime, Apple TV, Tubi, among others. She has also done numerous voiceovers and commercial spots for major brands, apps, and video games. Julia began acting at the age of 7, growing up performing in community theater, participating in dance classes, and taking voice and music lessons. She spends her free time with family, friends, and her puppy, Phineas.
Witness, Barbara Bockwith, 21, missing since December 5th, 1979, from Pensacola, Florida. Sometimes I believe that I can call you into this poem, capture the small details of your life, your red car sparking through an intersection, your small hand waving to a friend as you pass by. This would somehow be a metaphor for loss, for grief, for a final goodbye. But maybe I'm wrong to meet you in lines like these. What kind of resurrection can I offer as the traffic light blinks from green to red? Like you, I place my bags on the passenger seat, throwing out my hand at every stop to keep them from tumbling to the floor. Maybe we both drive so fast that we often miss the way the landscape shifts around us. But what if you always drove with care? The force of your will keeping everything in order. I am an outsider. My own hand raised, hoping you're not going so fast you can't tell I am not waving goodbye.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.